From Autosport.com and Autosport Magazine, I'm Stephen Licorice, and this is the Autosport National Podcast. So one of the major car racing events that took place last weekend was the Donington Historic Festival, which has backed to being a full three-day event this year. And I'm delighted to say that I've got a special guest with me to look back on some of the best action from the weekend. So Nigel Greensall is one of the busiest drivers in club motorsport. He's almost always out racing something somewhere, and he's found time in his hectic schedule to join us on the podcast today. So Nigel, welcome. How are you?
Oh, good morning, Stephen. Yeah, welcome. Yeah, it's great to be here. And as you say, we've just had Donington Historic Festival, which was a truly magnificent event.
Yes, absolutely. And we'll get into some of the details of the event very shortly on the podcast. But first of all, for any listeners who are not familiar with Nigel, he's a really prolific racer. He often races over 100 races in a year. So can you perhaps just give us a flavour of some of the different range of cars and events that you often compete in, Nigel?
Yes, of course. Well, I've raced for over 30 years now, and racing and then coaching drivers is my whole life. So as you say, last year I managed to do 107 races and 5 rallies all around the world. So kept myself very busy, and then sort of midweek I'm always at tracks coaching drivers, either new drivers that are just coming into the sport that I'm helping, or more experienced drivers that I've worked with for 5, 10 or 15 years, and developing their skills and helping them set their cars up and take that forward.
Absolutely. And you were with one of your regular co-drivers at the weekend at Donington, John Spears, and you were in 5 different cars, I believe, across the course of the weekend, and you came very close to winning quite a number of those races, but didn't quite work out on this occasion. And I guess one of the closest was in the Historic Racing Drivers Club Jack Sears Trophy, which is for pre-1966 tin tops, because after Sam Tordoff's Ford Mustang retired from the lead, you were in front and looked on course for victory, but it didn't quite work out like that.
Oh, it was heartbreaking. It was such a shame because Historic Automobiles that prepared the Mustang, we'd worked with them for a number of years, and this Mustang actually drove the previous owner, David Gooding, and then he was looking to sell it, and John Spears, who I've raced with for a number of years now in lots of cars, was looking for a pre-66 touring car, so I recommended the Mustang, and that introduced him to Simon Blake's Historic Automobiles team as well, and John bought the Mustang a couple of years ago and loves it. And we've had loads of really good races in pre-66 touring cars over the years. And this was another real sort of great race where John had driven a fabulous early stint. As you say, Sam Tordoff just had a little bit more pace early in the race. So he'd built up a little bit of a lead. But then after the pit stops, I jumped in and was coming up through the field and managed to get fastest lap, which I was thrilled with, and ended up in the lead when Sam retired. And going into the last lap, I think we'd got something like 4-second lead. Everything was fantastic. And I was thinking, oh, this is great. Yeah, just stay flat out, just keep going. And as I came around the hairpin onto the start finish straight to start the last lap, the fuel pressure just died until it went to zero, and I saw the gauge sort of light up red, and it went to zero, and the car coughed and spluttered and died. So I coasted down the pit straight round Redgate, desperately trying to refire it, and as I went down the crane of curves, I was trying to bump start it, and I was thinking, there's got to be a way I can do this last half a lap, you know. I was thinking, it's too heavy to push the car, so I've got to try and get this engine refired. And then I got around the old hairpin looking for somewhere safe to stop, and I thought, I'm just going to press the starter one more time. You know, it's sort of like in the sort of like ever optimistic hope of, yeah, something will be good. And it burst into life. And so I was like, oh, let's go. So I was then drove flat out for the last half a lap and finished the race. And the car ran perfectly. And it was like, well, that's most peculiar, you know. We got back to the paddock and I talked to Simon and Mark, who run the car, and, you know, we turned it off. And then back in the paddock, when they were about to load it onto the truck, they pressed the starter and it fired up again. So we don't actually know what happened. It's obviously a blockage in the fuel system or something, because it hadn't run out of fuel. But we don't understand. But today they're back in the workshop, so they'll now be going through the Mustang. But it's a most peculiar problem. But yeah, as you say, it's cost us the win, which was a real shame for John and the team.
Yeah, no, typically it would happen on that final lap. It couldn't wait until you're on the way back to the pits or something. And yeah, it's such a shame. But in the end, I think you finished fourth, despite that late drama, which was still a decent result. And the race ended up being won by Harry Reynolds, who is more... some of our listeners may know him from his days in Ginetta Junior, GB4, and he's out in British F4 the previous weekend and jumped from F4 to Lotus Cortina, which is not something that many young drivers are seen doing. And he was on some fantastic form. He fell to about 18th on the first lap after running through the old hairpin gravel when it all got a bit bunched up down into there on the opening lap. It was a massive field of cars, 43 cars, something like that. But he didn't panic. He kept it on the track and made a series of brake moves and was able to pounce when Nigel's Mustang had the unfortunate problem right at the end there. So that, all in all, it was a really great race with a great grid of cars, real mix of cars, and it was good battling throughout the order. And I guess from your side, Nigel, that was one race where you were in the lead and then had a problem. But another race that you very nearly won was the pre-63 GT contest. And this time you were the driver doing the chasing, trying to see if you could hunt down Gregor Fiskin in another AC Cobra. You're in a Shelby Cobra, and you're both in Cobras. And it was building towards a bit of a crescendo, that one.
It was such a great race, because of course this weekend Gregor had Dario Franchitti sharing with him, so it was wonderful, to spend a little bit of time with Dario, get to know him a little bit, and be on the same grid as him, having watched him race and admired his racing and the amazing success he's had through the years, and the fact that he's still got great passion for racing. And it's a sign of a real true racer, that, isn't it? And as you say, With Harry Reynolds, that has come from GB4 and the junior categories to come and do historics. It's something that when I'm sort of working with drivers and coaching them, whether they're youngsters or more mature drivers, it's being able to adapt to so many different cars, and you learn so many different skills. And I'm sure he'll sort of, with his experience of jumping into historics for the first time last weekend, he'll have gained so much experience from that he'll take with him, that'll make him an even better racer in the junior categories and through his single seater career. So that would be good. And obviously Dario's coming from the other angle of like having one IndyCar. And I was laughing with our team at the weekend when after qualifying, when sort of we were on the pole and Dario was second, and I was like, this is really cool, because he's won 4 IndyCar championships and I've won 4 Fun Cup championships, and here we are with a grid together. So I was like, that makes Fun Cup look really good.
But that's the great thing about the event, isn't it? There's the drivers from all sorts of different backgrounds, whether they're regular historic races that achieve great things like Dario has. We had Guy Smith, Le Mans winner, was out in his Cortina, and it's such a great mix of different drivers that are on those different grids. And I know, remember you said to me at the weekend, you were trying everything to try and catch down Gregor Fiskin in that pre-63 GT race, but just didn't quite have the laps remaining to do so.
That's right, yeah. And it was a great race, because obviously Dario took the start in their car and John always takes the start in our car, as owners normally do. And John, as it was, got caught up a little bit in traffic at the beginning of the race, but then drove a real storming stint and was up to P2 before the pit stops and turning in some fine laps. Dario had sort of extended a lead and had a nice comfortable cushion, so I knew going in that I'd just got to be absolutely flat out every single lap trying to catch Gregor, and drove the wheels off the thing, and I was thrilled with the lap times I got, but we just ran out of a number of laps to be able to catch Gregor. But it was a great race, loved it.
Absolutely. And as we mentioned earlier, you and Nigel, you're out in such a range of different cars over the weekends. You also had the Ford Capri, Jaguar E-Type, and a Lister Nobly. What's it like sort of jumping between all the different cars during the course of the weekend? And sometimes the races are back to back and there's almost no time to blink.
Exactly, yeah. And it's something that it's lovely for myself racing for John Spears on a weekend like this, because he's a real true racer and loves pretty much everything about motor racing. It's a real passion of his, and you can see the glint in his eye, and when it's time to go racing, he really comes alive. It's fantastic to see. So we share that same passion. And as I say, the sort of real great drivers are able to adapt from one car to another and have that natural feel. And and as a kid, sort of growing up in the 70s, and it was then that sort of it was watching people like Ronnie Peterson and Hans Stuck when I was a kid, and it was watching them go from Formula One to BMW touring cars to Formula 2 and sports cars. And for me, that's what motorsport is all about. Being a real race driver, it's jumping from car to car. And this past weekend, as you say, we had the Lister Nobly, which is like 1950s Le Mans car, if you like, through into like the 60s with the Cobra and the E-Type. And then you've got the Capri. So a real nice mix of cars. Some are right-hand drive, some are left-hand drive. And they've got totally different tyres on some of them and everything like that. The characteristics are different, and you just have to switch on to this, and it develops a really good feel. And the more you do it, the more you can adapt. But also, it means that you're really refining your skills as well as a driver. So you're much more sensitive to what's going on with the car. And it helps you get more out of each car and also more out of yourself.
Yeah, definitely. It certainly keeps you on your toes when you're having to think of all those different changes that you have to adapt to for each one. Like you say, even just the driving position, let alone anything of the actual characteristics of the car itself.
Sorry, Steve, it's funny because I was just thinking back to when we're doing the driver changes. I'll stand in the pit lane waiting for John to come down, and then I'm trying to think, now then, so we're in the Mustang this time, so, oh, that's left-hand drive, right? I need to stand that side of the pit lane. And then, oh, the Capri, right-hand drive, oh, right, I need to stand this side of the pit lane. So sometimes I'm hovering around in the middle of the pit lane trying to work out, oh, is it left-hand drive or right-hand drive? That's what I'm about to get in.
That's incredible. Just so many different things that you have to think about during the course of the race weekend. It's brilliant.
Remembering which gear you need in which car for which corner. Because the engine is so different. It's like some of them need first gear for the hairpins and some second, and then some are third gear down to the craners and the old hairpin, and some fourth for the craner but third gear for the old hairpin. And so it goes on. So you're then remembering all of this as you back to get into the car, knowing that you've got time to sort of mess around on the outlap. You've got to be absolutely on it. So it's a great challenge. It really brings you alive.
Yeah, no, that's a really good point, because there's such competitive fields that there's no time to sort of ease yourself in. You've got to be right on the pace right from the start if you're going to be fighting at the front. So yeah, definitely
every lap has to be flat out. People say, oh, historic racing, it's sort of, you have to look after the cars, and absolutely we do, but you look after the car in such a way that you're still driving totally flat out, so it's every tenth of a second counts.
Yeah, it's the balance between those two very different sort of ideas and concepts, isn't it? You're trying to go fast, but also not going so fast that the car breaks down before you finish. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah, and that again sort of makes you more sensitive to everything in the car. So it helps really give you more feel, because all of them are manual gear shifts, so you have to heel and toe correctly. You have to manage the brakes to make sure that they'll last the distance and so on. All the time, going absolutely flat out. So, yeah, it's a wonderful challenge. I love it.
Absolutely. And out of those five cars that you were competing in during the course of the weekend, is there one that's a particular favourite of yours that you particularly enjoy racing?
Not at all. All of them. I love all of them. As you were asking that question, I was thinking, now then, and I was thinking, there really isn't, because the Cobra is a really fun car to drive. You know, they're short wheelbase, they're quite twitchy, and I think Dario said over the weekend that he found it a real tricky car to drive because it's a real knife edge car. So I love that, of being really on the knife edge and really on the limit. And then you get a step into something like the Mustang, which is like sitting on a great big sofa in your lounge, sort of like wallowing around, and you turn the steering wheel, and at some point further down the lap, the car actually steers into a corner, and the brakes, you apply the brakes as you begin the straight, not at the end of the straight, to try and slow the thing down. It's brilliant, and it's got so much power that you're just drifting everywhere. So you're trying to see how long the black lines can be coming out of each turn with the Mustang. It's hilarious. And then you get into something like the Lister, and that feels much more like a pure race car, because, of course, those were built, you know, as, you know, sports cars for Le Mans and stuff. And all of a sudden, you've got this wonderful Jaguar engine, and you're sat virtually on the back axle. And it's, it's a real pure race car, that one. So the contrast from each, they're all so different. I love them all.
Yeah, it's like choose a favourite child. It's impossible to pick between them.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And obviously we talked there about some of the cars that you were racing during the course of the event. And this year's Donington Historic Festival was the first one since Sean Lynn took over Motor Racing Legends, which is the organisation behind many of the races that take part at the event. And Sean has made quite a few changes to the organisation in the sort of short time he's been in charge. So what did you make of the first big event since he's took the helm, really?
It was fantastic. What's interesting is obviously you've got Sean, you've got his son Max. They've hired Pierre Antoine as well, who I've known through events in France and around Europe in historic racing, and he's very, very good. And the team that they're building seems to be really good, and they seem to have a good vision of what's required going forward. And it was interesting over the weekend that the way they had the paddock organised, so all of the cars were on display within their own grids, within their own marquees. I really like that, because I always think of it as a fan coming into the paddock. You know, can you find your way around? Can you go and see the cars you want to look at? And they're not sort of in amongst trucks and tents and all kinds of stuff like that, you know. And so that was a real good step forward. And obviously, they've got this link with supercar track days as well. So there's a whole bunch of modern supercars. So what would be nice is that brings a new audience in, and it may be that some of those guys will then come and race within historic racing, or even the more modern, like the GT3 Legends series that they've created as well. And so, you know, for motorsport, we need to be much more inclusive and sort of encouraging people to become part of this amazing sport that we're lucky to be part of.
Yeah, definitely. And you can really see, particularly on the Sunday, there was a really good crowd there. It was queuing to get into the circuit. And they did a pit lane walkabout during the lunch break, and there was lots of fans getting up close to the cars, and particularly the GT3 Legends cars that, as you mentioned, that's a new introduction for this year. They did a pilot race at the end of last year, which was successful. And then they've now got a series of races for those cars this year, starting at Donington. And that's one of the things, as time marches on, do you think it's important that historic organisers sort of embrace that in a way and do look to put on races for more modern machines? These GT3 Legends cars cater for some of the older GT3 cars that aren't used in current GT3 races, but there's so many of these cars out there, it's great to be able to find a home for them. So do you think it's important that organisers sort of see that and do continue to develop new ideas, such as the GT3 Legends?
Absolutely, yeah, because I can remember racing GT3 at Silverstone in like 2009, and it's all that sort of era of cars, and you think, well, that's like 15, 16 years ago, you know? And so It's lovely that these cars, are getting back out on track, because I always think, if anybody collects race cars, they shouldn't just put them in a museum or hide them away. They should get them on track because it's a race car. That's what it was built for. And it's a generational thing as well, isn't it? That you think back sort of 15 or 20 years and the folk that were watching those cars and aspiring to those cars, it's that sort of generation now that are sort of coming into the sport and thinking, well, what cars excited them? What cars made them think about going racing? And GT3 just appeals to so many different people because it's such a broad range of different manufacturers. When I was down at Goodwood members meeting, I was doing the GT3 demo with the Morgan, but then also hosting a couple of hundred guests on each day and taking them for paddock tours. And I was taking them around the GT3 paddock, and they, a lot of the guests that were new to motor racing, this is their first experience of being at a racetrack and seeing race cars, and they were aware of all the historic cars that were in the paddock, and I gave them a tour of that and explained what was going on. But you could see that they could really understand the GT3 cars because they see a Ferrari or a Porsche or a Morgan or whatever it may be, or Corvette, and that they really get that, and they love the variety and the sound, and they're very big, spectacular cars. So I love the GT3 Legends. It's fantastic.
Yeah, and that's a really good point you make about the sort of the cars that you grew up watching, and you're more interested in those potentially than some of the older machines. And it, like you say, it's just keeping that keeping people involved, trying to get a new group of people involved. And it's also quite nice because some of the sort of long-standing motor racing legends competitors have also embraced that and have bought older GT3 cars and have got on that grid as well. So it's a real mix of different drivers, some of whom did race those GT3 cars when they were new, and some of them are more sort of traditional historic racers that are moving into something a little bit more modern for the first time. So it's a really nice mix of different people involved.
It's great, and I've tested quite a number of the cars on the GT3 Legends grid and coached a number of the drivers. And actually, hopefully, I'll be out on that grid during the season as well with some clients. And it's what's been interesting for me is because I'm familiar with current sort of GT3 cars, with the racing that I do in America and everything, that I'm able to use that experience and help these guys that are coming from the historic cars and then stepping up to a GT3 and trying to sort of help them get their head around how different it is, like the different technology in the car and what you need to do as a driver, but also helping the teams understand what they need to do as a team and how to think differently in terms of how, when you're setting a car up, it's very different to how you set up an E-Type or a Lotus Elan or a Chevron B8 or whatever it may be, to help these teams think totally different when they're coping with a GT3 car. It's a big challenge for the teams as well as the drivers stepping up.
Yeah, definitely. No, I think that series, it's got a really bright future. It's a great idea, and it's been very popular right from the start, which is always good to see. And it meant that there was almost 100 years worth of cars in action at Donington. So we had the pre-war machines that is part of the Mad Jack race, all the way up through to the GT3 Legends. So such a broad mix of cars. And again, that really helps from a spectator's point of view as well, because there's so many different things to see and watch during the course of the event. And for you, Nigel, were there any other particular highlights of the event, either from your own experiences or for any of the action that you watched during the event?
Well, it was just great. As I say, the atmosphere around the paddock was fantastic. And I think it's something we can do more sort of within motorsport to encourage people to become part of these events. And something that happens in America, because I do a lot of racing in America, both modern and historic, and something that they do in America, and I don't know whether it's ever possible to do in the UK, but they have what they call a track touring session at lunchtime, where everybody, spectators and everybody, can pay, in America, I think they pay sort of $20, and they can follow a safety car in their own road car and drive around the circuit, and they get 3 or 4 laps behind a safety car. But it's that sort of experience that people then go, oh, this is what the track's like to go around. Because as a spectator, you stand at one corner and you watch and you kind of get a little perspective, but you don't understand all the contours and elevation changes and everything about the circuit. But when you drive it yourself, even at 30 mile an hour in a road car, suddenly you go, wow, oh, now I found this, you know. Things like that, with the organisers trying to get people more included and more part of the excitement of it, it's things like that I think we can really help.
Definitely. No, it's all about embracing new ideas. And Donington would be a perfect venue for that, given the elevation changes there are over the course of the lap. It would really give those watching the action an insight just to exactly what it's like to drive around the track. And I think one of the things that's really striking about some of the grids there, particularly some of the Historic Racing Drivers Club grids, is just the sheer diversity of cars that there are among the fields. Like, for example, in that Jack Sears Trophy race that we were talking about earlier, there was the Cortinas and the Mustangs and the Minis that you'd expect to see. But there's also a huge range of other cars as well, far more unusual things. Like you had British Touring Car driver James Dorlin out in a Ford Zephyr, and just very unusual cars like that. And it's great to see these grids have such a variety and cars that you very rarely see out racing. And it's good to see that they've got a home on these ones.
It is. And the HRDC is just an amazing club. You know, what the HRDC do is just incredible. When you look at the Jerry Marshall Trophy and the Jack Sears Trophy, just those two grids that were at Donington, and you look at how big the grid is and you see the variety of cars, and you think, that is what motor racing is all about. You know, everybody's out there having absolutely brilliant time. You know, there's lots of different classes and everybody's got something to sort of chase and everything like that. But the spirit is really great. That the driving standards are fantastic. You know, there's nobody bashing into each other or anything like that. They're proper driving proper races and respecting each other on the track. And the spectacle for spectators is fantastic because that variety of the sounds of the different cars and how they all look, how they all perform, and some are quick on corners and some are quick on straights, and it makes for great racing. So yeah, the HRDC is doing a really, really great job.
Yeah, definitely. And that Jerry Marshall Trophy grid that you mentioned for Group 1 touring cars, the great thing about that is the cars are all in period-inspired liveries. So it really looks like a fantastic... Not only is it... you've got the range of different cars, the range of different colours and sponsors and liveries you see on them. It really does make for quite an impressive sight, I always think.
I totally agree. I was in that one. I was with John in the Hermitite Capri, which I remember as a kid watching at Mallory Park when it was Group 1 touring cars, and they used to go to Mallory Park. And we had a great time because in qualifying in John's first lap, we had a stub axle fail, so we didn't get to do any qualifying laps, which meant we started 33rd on the grid. And so me and John and Nikki, my wife, and John's partner, Jane, and the team, we're all having bets right then. From starting 33rd, where are we going to finish, you know? And Nikki and Jane were like, oh, we think you're going to get a podium. And me and John were like, no way, you know? And I said, well, you know, if we have an amazing race, we might get sixth. And as it was, we ended up fourth. So it provided a great race. It really did. And the pit stops are great because the pit stops in those races are as fast as you can do them. So me and John have practiced so that we're really quick jumping in and out. And that gained us a couple of spots as well. And John's opening stint, I think he gained like 20 places before the pit stop, which is just incredible. So we love that racing.
Yeah, definitely. And you mentioned the sound earlier of the different cars. And one of the other sounds that those at Donington got to experience was during the demonstration runs. There was two sets of demonstrations. There was a whole mix of super touring cars that took to the track. But there was also the chance to, a very special chance, to hear two V10 engine Formula One cars lapping Donington. We had Rob Spence out in a Benetton B198 from 1998, Giancarlo Fisichella car. And then we had six-time Indy 500 starter James Davison, who was out in a a Williams Heritage Williams FW22. And it was just fantastic hearing those cars. You don't often get to hear them these days in the UK. And we've heard so much debate about whether F1 should bring back V10s or not and everything. But it was just a wonderful chance to hear those glorious sounds once again and seeing those cars in action as well. And just adds another element to the event.
It really does. It's wonderful that Williams come along with that car and put on the display. And as you say, it was great to be able to hear them go around the track, and particularly when there's only one or two on the track, because then you really get to appreciate the sound all the way around the circuit and what the, you know, you could start to visualize what the driver's doing. It was glorious. It took me back to when I used to race in the Euroboss series, because we ran the V10 Judd engines in the Tyrrells, and then ran the V8s in the Benetons from sort of like the mid-90s. It's sort of similar sort of era. And it's glorious to hear the sounds of those sort of cars.
Absolutely. And James in particular was really pushing in the Williams. He was quite taken aback by the sort of G-forces down the Craner curves in the Williams. But it was just a great sight and another fantastic addition to the event. And it, as we said before, the event covered a huge range of different cars. But Nigel, what's the sort of next on your calendar after a busy Donington Historic Festival? What's next coming up for you?
Well, I'm at Snetterton in an MGB, and then Goodwood in a BMW M3, doing some coaching, some testing, possibly in the Fun Cup race at the end of this week at Alton Park, and then back to Donington with Richard Chamberlain and his CTR sports prototype that runs in the Zero Sports Prototype Series. I raced that early in the year for him and his son Matthew. It's an amazing car that they've designed and built themselves and manufactured it. Incredible bit of kit, it really is. So we've got a day at Donington testing that next week, and then after that I head up towards Cadwell Park for CSCC. So I'll be racing a BMW 116. And then the next big event after that is Spa Classic, which is part of the Peter Auto series. So I'll be in a Chevron B19 in one of the races, a Porsche RSR in a race. And then we've got the Mustang, again, the Mustang race at Donington. John's bringing that to Spa. So we do the classic touring car series with that one. We've got the Lister coming out as well for the Gentleman Challenge with that one. And we'll have the E-Type and the 60s Endurance. So that'll be a good fun weekend, that one.
Yeah, another weekend in a huge variety of different machines. And you mentioned that the CTR prototype, and that's, again, something very different. And it's must be great to just be able to experience such a huge range of different cars.
It is, and it's lovely because Matthew and his dad, Richard, who Richard I've known for over 20 years now and raced with him in various cars and so on. And for them to be able to design and build and manufacture a car like this is quite incredible. And we'd been chatting for a while, and they said, "Oh, Nigel, we have to get you out in it, come and do a race." So at Brands Hatch a couple of weeks ago, I hopped in it and went out in qualifying for the first time in it to see what it was like. And within a few laps, we're going around the Brands Indy circuit in 44 seconds. And it's like, it's a really fast bit of kit. So we ended up on the front row, but unfortunately, an alternator belt failed. So we didn't get to get a result in the race, but we had a great time in qualifying anyway. But it's wonderful to see what people are able to produce themselves.
Yeah, and that's the great thing, isn't it? We sadly don't see it as much as we used to, but it's good that there's still those self-built, self-designed cars that you can still find in club motorsport and just add that real diversity to those grids. It's brilliant that there's still examples of that out there, which is just really special.
And I think it's a real shame that so much of motorsport has gone into like a one-make series, because such a shame for mechanics and engineers and designers that are coming up. And it's like, well, where do they go to explore their talents? When it's just one make, you lose so much of those skills, and it seems such a shame that does. But also for the drivers, that if it's a one make series, there's very small amounts of setup changes you can make to a lot of these cars. It's very pre-programmed, if you like. Whereas if all the cars are different, the driver can then work with the designer and the manufacturer and everything to help develop a car. And that will then bring out a lot more skills from all of those people involved and enable them to develop further.
Yeah, definitely. And also from the driving point of view, different cars have different strengths and weaknesses around the lap. So you have to play to those, and it just adds a different element that you don't have if it's all one make racing where you've all got the same tools at your disposal. Yeah.
Yes, yeah, and I think there is a place for one mate racing, but I'm not totally sure that we need one mate racing across the board. I think as you say, when you look at the Jerry Marshall Trophy and the Jack Sears Trophy and Donington generally with the historic festival, there's such a variety of cars on the grid, and that draws people in. People are excited by that because the different sights and sounds and so forth. And that brings people in. It gets people more excited than the same sound going by every time.
Yeah, no, definitely. And it's certainly all made for a very special weekend. It was a great weekend. We had some glorious sunshine. I myself got a little bit sunburnt out watching some of the races. So we don't always have it, Donington. It's not always so glorious, but it just added to it, making a really special weekend. And thank you very much to Nigel Greensill for joining us and giving some great insight there into some of the different cars and races that he was involved with. So thanks very much, Nigel, for joining us on the podcast.
Jim, thank you for the invite. And I really appreciate the time. It's lovely to be part of it.
Excellent. Well, thanks very much to Nigel. Thank you to the listeners. And we'll be back soon with another Autosport National podcast.